So what did you think of the first episode with Vanessa Abraham, the speechless SLP? I love how her story is starting out. If you missed it, episode one with the speechless SLP, we talked about why she became an SLP, what her life was like before the medical crisis, talked about the AAC gaze device, and just the perspective of laying speechless in that intensive care unit bed. In this episode two, we're going to be talking about the ugly truth about being speechless, and we're going to venture into the dark of the ICU, the dark of the lack of communication and AAC systems in hospitals, the endless blood supplies where late MRIs, no diagnosis, PMVs, barium trials, tracheostomy, PEG tubes, NG tubes, Strider, fear, grief, not being able to be the mother she thought she was going to be. All of these are some of the dark, dark truths of the thoughts that went through Vanessa's mind when she was laying in that ICU bed, speechless. So welcome to episode two of the Speechless SLP. Welcome back to episode two of the Missing Link for SLPs podcast, Speechless Series. I'm here with SLP Vanessa Abraham, and she's taking us on her ICU journey today. We're going to be talking about the ugly truth about being speechless. And Vanessa is the speechless SLP. After waking up in an ICU, after coming down with an undiagnosed medical condition, she wakes up in an ICU bed, unable to talk, ventilated and trached. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. So Vanessa, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
So today we're going to talk about the ugly truth of being in that hospital bed. And we're going to start our journey today with you in the ICU room. Now, I'm a medical SLP, and when I walk into ICU rooms, I have a perspective of beeping sounds and dark lights. Can you explain to us how you feel, what you see, what you hear, what you taste? Go through all of those emotions of being in an ICU bed.
Oh, gosh. What do I see, feel? Feel terrified. Feel a level of anxiety that I've never felt in my entire life. My room had a window, so I did get some daylight, but I just see machines, beeping, thumping noises, you know, machines just pumping things. I don't even know what in and out of my body. I see dozens of people. I don't even know exactly what their titles were. There were so many people walking in and out of my room, collecting blood samples for something, you know, various nurses coming in and out, talking to my husband about things, doctors doing rounds, you know, teams of people. I was at a teaching hospital, so there was a lot of people on my care. I didn't have family coming because they were all out of the area, and honestly, it wasn't appropriate to have a lot of visitors because I was in such a critical state, but it was just a very, very busy atmosphere, very loud, you know, with all the people coming and going and the machines and all the procedures, people coming in to take me in and out of my room to do brain scans and MRIs. So it's a very busy, busy environment.
Was it busy 24 hours a day?
Boy, sometimes it felt that way. There were some late night MRIs and some late night procedures being done that, you know, I wanted to sleep through, but due to anxiety, I wasn't able to sleep through. So, you know, they tried to minimize distractions at night, but sometimes procedures have to happen at 11 o'clock at night, just because staffing and the way things work in the hospital setting.
Were the lights down low?
Nighttime, yes, but daytime, it's a bright environment, bright white lights.
Okay, natural daylight.
Many times I wanted to sleep in the day, but they sure wouldn't let me.
Good.
I wanted to pull the covers over my head and have to close the blinds and just sweep the day away, but nope, PT, OT, speech are there. They're ready to go. And
let's go. Sit up.
Yep, exactly. Get out of bed. No, I can't.
I don't know if I ever told you, but I was in 2017 in a really bad motorcycle accident and ended up in a trauma unit and went through some of that where I remember the OT and PT walking in and they're like, let's go. And I'm like, what? Don't you realize I was just in an accident and like all of this is broken? And they're like, nope, let's go.
Oh my God.
Oh, not an intensive care unit, but it was a teaching hospital and I was grateful they had an inner door and an outer door and I just cherished the quiet.
Yep, I remember in the middle of the night too asking the nurse, can you put a sign on the door? Just mm-hmm. please be quiet. Mm-hmm. I just wanted mm-hmm. to sleep, but I can sympathize with that. I remember in the daytime too, people walking in and all right, it's, you know, PT and I'm thinking, no, look at me. I'm paralyzed. I don't want four or five people to help me get out of bed. This is humiliating. And
going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
With help.
All of that. And I think, no, and that's when those dark, dark suicidal depression thoughts hit you. Mm-hmm. You're just like, you know, maybe I'm better off being dead. I don't know. This is not the life I want to live or ever imagined living.
Well, when you don't know the answers to questions, your mind does go down those rabbit trails and you did not know the answer to what was going on.
Nope. I did not have a diagnosis at this point. Didn't know what the future would hold for me or my family. So of course, naturally your mind starts mm-hmm. thinking, wow, this could be the rest of my life. You know, maybe forever my husband's going to have to push me around in a wheelchair mm-hmm. or I'll be bedridden forever or speechless.
Or speechless. And you're not speechless because you're on the podcast.
Yep.
So we know you recover.
Yep.
Spoiler alert, kind of.
Yeah. I can't talk. I don't need AAC.
Not anymore. What was, while you were in the ICU, what was one of the kindest things you remember somebody doing? Because I remember one of the kindest things somebody doing for me in my trauma stay.
Oh my goodness. There's more than one, but I will never forget my nurses giving me a spa day. Yes, I just said spa day. Spa mm-hmm. day, like full blown pedicure, washed my hair. I was in a reclining chair and you know, I really couldn't move, but they reclined me.
Mm-hmm.
They washed my hair, did my toenail, shaved my leg, which, you know, that was a pretty gruesome project right there. But my husband told me many times, he goes, you were such a different person after they gave you that spa day.
Yeah.
It just made me feel human again.
My favorite time was when somebody cleaned my hair. I had a helmet on, thank goodness, but they cleaned and brushed my hair and braided it for me. And I swear I cried the whole way through it because I was feeling, and this story is about you, but you're bringing out emotions in me. So I'm sure you're bringing out emotions in our listeners who've also gone through traumatic events. The touch of kindness, the touch of compassion is so, so, so important in those who we work with.
Yeah, that hour or so that they spent doing that just lifted my spirits. It took me from, level 0 right up to 10. I was starting to feel human again and feeling hopeful. They gave me a sense of hope just by, you know, shaving my legs and washing my hair. It made me feel human again. And I will never forget that feeling.
Mm-hmm. So the perspective of lying in the bed, not feeling human, or as you say, the endless blood samples, the late night MRIs, not having that diagnosis. Now you mentioned you also had, you had told me earlier, as we were preparing for this interview, that you had a PMV, passing your valve. So tell me a little bit about that journey and your respiratory
journey. Oh, that was another terrifying experience. You know, again, you know how critical you are when a speech therapist walks in and starts talking to your husband about hitting you for a passing ear valve. You know, I work in the school setting, so I don't really work with PMVs very often, ever. And I'm so unfamiliar with the concept of a PMV. And that was just beyond terrifying. When they start telling me that this is what they're going to use on me and help me communicate again, I thought, this can't be my life. You got to be kidding me.
But you were draped? What's that like?
Terrifying, horrible. Secretions, suctioning. I wouldn't wish that process on anybody. I think due to the nature of my illness and the way things progressed, I had a higher level of secretions than typical. That was just horrific trying to manage all of that.
Were you able to say, hey, I need to be suctioned, or did you just have to wait?
I would, at that point, it was relying on an alphabet board.
Okay.
Or I would have, it was written down on a piece of paper and I would just point to it.
Point to that paper, those pre-made communication exchanges.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would use that word often.
Okay. Okay. And it was handwritten paper, right?
Yeah, I had some handwritten. I had the, like a QWERTY keyboard, alphabet board on a piece of paper. And then was slowly progressing from that point as I made slow gains. Mm-hmm. But that's only because I was an SLP. I knew that there's more out there than just, you know, words on a piece of paper. I could write eventually. I could progress from IGAs where I started out. You know, I knew that there were different levels of AAC. There's your low-tech AAC, and there's your mid-tech AAC, and then there's your high-tech AAC. But I knew all of this because of my background. Only because of that.
Thank goodness.
Oh, thank goodness is right. And I knew also because of my background that this was going to take a lot of work.
I'm working on a project getting more AACs into the medical setting and hoping to reach out to you and collaborate a bit as well, just on the need for that and what it feels like to lay there in the bed and not be able to speak. Jumping back to the pacemaker valve, I've been the SLP who's put a pacemaker valve for the first time on somebody and asked them to now and train them on using that valve. What's that? What was that like from your perspective?
It was surreal. There's so many thoughts that begin one of those things that it's indescribable until you walk through it. Again, one of those things you don't learn in grad school about how hard it is to vocalize with that on. And I don't know if it's just the nature of the disease that I had and the way the nerves innervating my lungs, how they were damaged in the illness, that made it more difficult for me. That I don't know, because I haven't had strokes or other things. You know, I just know my diagnosis and what it felt like for me. But it was a lot of work. It took a lot of lung strength, and I didn't have a lot of lung strength. But to be able to produce that sound was exhausting.
So getting that pressure below the pacemaker valve to build it up to come through the pacemaker valve is what took a lot of effort.
Yeah.
How long approximately were you in the hospital before they first placed a pacemaker valve on? How many days had you had to decondition?
I would say by a week, a little, maybe over a week or so.
Okay. So outline your stay for us. You go to the emergency room, and then you're in the emergency room. The intensive care unit. How long were you in the intensive care unit?
About a month.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
And then where were you after the intensive care?
After that, I was sent to two different rehab facilities. One was an LTAC, where they decannulated me. And then the last one was kind of like my final... final rehab facility before I came home. That's where I just did the intensive every day, 1 hour of each therapy session.
How long was your LTAC stay?
LTAC was another 2 weeks, and then the final rehab was an additional 2 weeks.
Okay, so a month in ICU, a month in rehab, and then you came home?
Yep.
And home health care?
Yep, home health from there for about a week or two, and then I started outpatient.
All right. And you are now about 3 years post?
Yeah.
Everything.
Now, this is about my 3-year anniversary month.
Okay. So let's jump back to our hospital visit. Thanks for rolling that out and giving us the bigger picture. So we're going to talk next about the barium trials and tracheostomy, NG tube, PEG tube. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that like?
Barium trials, it takes me back to grad school when they had us just trial barium for fun.
Does not taste like marshmallow cream.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, this is so different than trialing it in grad school for fun when you're actually doing it to see if you can pass. Because I didn't do well on those barium trials. And that was another thing that was just terrifying. I think about my SLPs and how terrifying and how sad it was probably for them to look at my husband and I and, and say, look, she's still NPO.
The beauty of everything today is, in my approach in bariums, has not been a pass or not pass, but look what we're learning.
Yeah.
And look how we can compensate and help you improve your overall safety with the swallowing challenges that you have and the change in the mechanism of the swallow. So you're sitting in the chair, you're doing the barium swallow trials, and I'm sure it is the stress of passing, not passing. What was it like receiving the, let's keep you a non-oral for a little while?
Oh, depressing. I just shut down. I felt like a failure. You know, I wanted to get better for my family. I wanted to get better for my husband so he didn't have to tube feed me. And I just felt like complete failure to everyone. I felt bad for my SLPs too. I know that seems crazy, but I felt bad for them because I thought, oh, poor girls have to sit here and do another barium swallow study with me. And how hard it is for them to look at me and just say, oh, no, I'm still not, you know. I felt bad for them because I know as an SLP how hard those conversations are and how gut-wrenching they can be to look at this caregiver and the emotions tied up with it. And not only that, but they're treating another SLP. These poor girls, and my heart broke for them too.
Did they seem sad?
I think they were trying to be professional. You know, I honestly think that when they probably left the room, they probably thought, oh gosh, you know, they're trying to keep it together. I can't speak for them, but I think they were trying to maintain a level of professionalism and do their job and execute it, being professionals. But I can't imagine that they wouldn't walk out of the room and just, because I know that's how I would be. I know if another SLP came into my room and, you know, presented with the case that I had, undiagnosed medical condition, PMV, all of this stuff, that I would just probably go home at night, collapse with emotion.
What was it like when you started eating again, when you were cleared to, well, let's back up. So your NPO, I'm sure you did swallow dysphagia therapy and they were giving you oral trials and teaching you strategies and things like this. What was it like being a patient of dysphagia therapy?
Yeah, best word I can describe it is just terrifying. I keep going back to the word terrifying and those things that you don't learn in grad school.
That's why this series is so important.
You just don't learn these things in a textbook. What these patients go through emotionally, you know, it's, I had a child on top of it that I was worried about. I was terrified of what her future was going to be like if this was my forever.
And thankfully, you progressed through your dysphagia. You began consistent oral intake. What were some of those first bites like?
Oh, there's so much anxiety. Is this gonna be successful? Am I going to choke? You know, some of those, I'm sure, very common fears of most people with swallowing disorders. Is this going to go down the wrong tube? Am I going to have to be readmitted, or somebody going to have to do the Heimlich on me? Or, you know, the thoughts that go through your mind with speech, swallowing, communication disorders. It's just, again, you don't learn these in grad school. They're very dark, dark, scary thoughts.
How did you press forward through those thoughts? How did you remain as positive as you could be and being brave?
I would say my outpatient speech therapist was very uplifting for me. She was like my little bit of sunshine. Her smile was just contagious, and she made me feel safe during those trials. But those thoughts can easily drift right back into your head, and thoughts of self-doubt, and it's real.
Yeah. The suicidal ideation, you said you struggled with that a little bit.
Oh, big time. Not just a little. It's terrifying. Your life gets flipped upside down overnight. And I think it's one of those things too. If I was, 70, 80, it might be, I wouldn't say easier, but you expect it more.
Mm-hmm.
This just came out of nowhere. Like I said in my first podcast, I was never sick. I always had just the common cold and, but nothing that ever wound me up in emergency. Not even like an urgent care setting. I would always just fight through any sinus infections with some NyQuil and sleep it off, right, and I'd be fine within a couple of days.
Right, right, right. Much less the journey that you have embarked upon.
This wasn't just a little journey. This was, from the state of being very active to being, limb paralysis, swallowing, PTOT, all of it. So
when I have a patient where I do a video swallow study and I might recommend something that the patient I know is not hoping for, I try to prevent it in the most positive way I can. Look what you can do by following these recommendations. This minimizes your risk. What other words of wisdom would you give to the speech pathologist who is working with somebody who's starting to eat again and making them feel safe?
I think that is huge right there, because I remember my outpatient therapist saying that to me too and saying, look, 2 weeks ago you were only eating this. Look where you are now. A lot of that cognitive behavioral therapy of reframing your thoughts. Because my thoughts, and this is probably who I am, but my thoughts naturally just gravitate to the negative, the bad. And instead of saying, I can't do this, reframe that to I can. I can eat. One of the first things she had me eating, or obviously with her, was, the applesauce and the crackers and, things like that, trialing those. But like, I can eat applesauce now, or I can eat this cracker, I can eat this hard-boiled egg, as opposed to I can't. Your brain needs to hear the positives, and naturally your brain hears the negatives, and that's where you get in trouble.
And that's been a mental wellness approach I've heard you say several times, where when your mind does start going down some of those dark trails in an ICU bed, in a barium swallow study chair, where you're able to say, nope, I'm going to reframe this and muscle it back into being positive.
Yep, and think about what you're grateful for, the good things that are going on in your life. Journaling, writing a gratitude journal of things that have happened to you. I did that in ICU, and even reading through that now, that's a big part of recovery is your mental well-being.
Was there ever a time when a therapist told you, you're going to be doing this? And I'm trying to think of how I want to ask that question, because I don't promise false hope. And I believe when I work with the people I work with, I have a good idea of where they can go, what their prognosis is. Was there ever a time, though, when you worked with somebody and they said, Vanessa, we're going to do this, and you're like, nah, no way, I'm not going to get back there? Was there ever a time you didn't believe somebody?
I think I always had my doubts with all of my providers. That's, again, my brain going towards the dark side. I remember my husband having conversations with me and saying that you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And I love him immensely, and the things he did for me were just amazing. But sometimes I just wanted to slap him over the head. as crazy as that sounds, I was so grateful. But at the same sense, it was just want to look at them and say, honey, look at me. I can't even get out of the car. I can't even toilet myself. How am I going to climb that mountain? Which I just climbed that mountain with my outpatient SLP a couple weeks ago, just as an anniversary of where we are together now. But yeah, many times that I remember my husband trying to be encouraging over the years and saying, look what you're doing now, look where you are, and you'll do this, you'll do that. And sometimes I just wanted to be negative and just be in my dark place.
So when we work with somebody, a therapist who is negative and they're in their dark place, what would you recommend we do?
Really good question. Just keep, help them keep the faith, find something to be hopeful for in their life. Try to see what it is in their life that can give them hope, a reason to continue on, a reason to keep fighting. Mm-hmm. For me, it's young. I have a family still. I want to be able to retire with my husband and live a great retirement life. I want to be there for my daughter when she graduates from school, and I want to see her grow up. And to me, and even today, those are the reasons that I keep fighting. And I believe every patient or everybody has something that they want to fight for.
I love that. I love that mountaintop. I'm planting my flag, and this is what I'm fighting for. And on that flag is my daughter and my family and my husband and me, because this is where I'm going.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a vision board of goals. Mm-hmm. This is what I want to accomplish. This is where I see myself, because it's so, I've said it before, but it's easy to go down the other path.
It is.
You need to look to the future and say, this is where I visualize myself. This is what I want for my life. And this is where I'm headed. This is not my forever. This is temporary.
Oh, yeah. More goosebumps. I do vision boarding because I do coaching for SLPs on the side. And I believe in vision boards because after my husband died and my world got turned around, I was lost. Where am I going to go? What am I going to do? And I created that vision board. And until we have the clarity sometimes of where we want to go, it's hard to picture us getting there. So I love the vision boarding. I love the visual flag.
Love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It should almost be incorporated into a therapy session that you have each patient just spend that 30-minute session making a vision board, because without them being in a positive mental state, I don't know how much they could still make progress, but that mental state is so important for their healing. To want to die and not want to continue to fight is counterproductive to the healing process.
Mm-hmm. And you've been there.
Yep.
You've had those thoughts.
Yep. Fight through those.
And you've made that choice to plant that flag on top of the hill. What an interesting concept, vision boarding with our patients. I find vision boarding to be incredibly powerful tool. And I know as SLPs, we, what do you want to do? Where do you want to go? We pull that patient and client input in, but to have a more focused vision of where do you want to go? And that is the important part of buy-in with the people we work with. We need them to buy into what we're asking them to do.
Mm-hmm. And trust you mm-hmm. as an SLP.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate. I trusted my providers. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate that I was in a setting that had wonderful, wonderful people working underneath me and mm-hmm. working with my family. And I have so much respect and so much trust in them and their care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
What did they particularly do that contributed to that trust building?
Gosh, if I had to think of one thing that they did.
Or two or three.
Well, I just think it was the way that they approached and took in my whole family. I think they recognized that I was worried about my husband.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was worried about his mental state, and they looked after him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were always there for him, educating him, making sure he had enough sleep, he was eating. And the fact that they were looking after him, who I care immensely about, and they were also asking about my child, my parents, they were asking the right questions, gave me a lot of peace. And I think that's probably what led to me trusting them like I did. Because they could sense that, okay, we need to address the whole person here.
And her family. And everybody else in the journey along with her.
Yeah, the big picture here. It's not just her. Yes, she's in a critical state in bed. But she has a family here. Her husband's very involved. My husband was wonderful. He attended doctor rounds. And they could see that, I required a lot, and they rose to the challenge. And I could see that.
You mentioned earlier that you had a lot of fear and grief about not being able to be the mother that you had envisioned for yourself. How did you turn that around? Was that through some of those conversations and relationships you had built with your providers?
I've had a lot of counseling, a lot. From the minute I got out of the medical setting, out of rehab, I've had various forms of counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, hypnosis, a lot of different treatment approaches to work on some of that. So it's been a whole body experience. Healing the mind.
Healing the mind as well as the body. I think, you've mentioned several times, we have another podcast series, What I Didn't Learn in Grad School, which you keep saying, I didn't learn this in grad school. I didn't learn this in grad school. One of the things that I did not learn in grad school was the mind-body connection on when you have a body or a mind that goes through trauma. And you laying in an ICU bed is trauma. It's traumatic. We're going to talk in our future episodes about PICS, post-intensive care syndrome. And I'm looking forward to, we're going to be pulling on a counselor there or somebody you've worked with there as right as well.
Yes. Yeah. She is one of the social workers that I was referred to at a different hospital. And she addresses PICS, the post-intensive care syndrome. So that's a very interesting and new topic. Most people that I talk to when I mention PICS, they say, well, what is that? They don't have any idea of what that is. And I love talking about it because nobody knows what it is. And it's it's so real. And so many ICU patients experience this, but it's not talked about. So I'm very excited about that episode. I think that's going to be great for all to hear.
We have some great, great episodes coming. Before, though, we stop for today, I want to talk briefly about being an AAC user and what that was like. You mentioned you were trying to be so patient with your providers by trying to slow down and typing on the alphabet board, but you got frustrated because they couldn't understand and readily understand what you were saying or trying to communicate.
Yeah, my poor providers were so frustrated with me. And I had so much to say. So I was cognitively aware. Therefore, I had a lot of questions. I wanted to know what's going on. What are you doing? What procedure is this? And why are you doing this? And why do they keep taking blood? And, all these questions. And my questions were very lengthy and length. So for me to type letters was just so frustrating for them. They get frustrated. I get frustrated. But I wanted to know what was going on. So it was a very frustrating process for all of us, but they were so patient.
What was the wisdom then do you have for somebody who is waiting for a patient to use their AAC system?
Just keep being patient. Take some deep breaths and just wait for them to get their words out because, your patients that are aware of what's going on, they're terrified. They want to know, my anxiety was so high that I wanted to know every procedure, what time people were coming, what they were going to do, what they're looking for, what the results of tests were. I wanted to know. And, my providers, again, were wonderful. They were so patient with me, but I could tell that they would say, slow down, what was that? or they would try to word predict what I was saying, and like, no, that's not the word. And it was a very, very frustrating process for all of us. But now that I look back, it's kind of like a memory, and I can find some humor in it, and I can smile about it now. Whereas then I just wanted to throw my papers out the window, the 10th floor, wherever I was.
I would imagine laying in the bed, you felt such a loss of control. And as a professional, you know when your next student is, you know when your meetings are. And all of a sudden, your world is so tipped up, upside down. You don't even know who or where's, who's walking through the next, your door the next, and why and where your bed's being whisked off to. I remember just laying on my gurney and I see the ceiling going by and I'm like, where am I going? So maybe from your perspective, what we learned from you is also to help ease our patient's journey is to fill in some of those missing blanks, give them some of that control back, where they can look at a schedule and know who's coming in.
Loss of control is huge. I had no control. I went from, hate to say it, but having the most control in my family. I was, in charge of everything, scheduling, planning, executing, booking everything from birthday parties to work events to IEP meetings at school, and then to be unable to do any of that, not even like get myself to the bathroom. It's hard to accept.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to more episodes with you. Right now, we are still working on pulling everybody's schedules together, but we have your husband coming on, Dale Abraham. We have Dr. Rosen coming on, your PICS social worker, Anna Lewis.
Yep.
And we have your nurses coming on, Sharon Cotton and Laura Davis. Jess O'Brien is your PT, Danielle Torres and Sherry Ewing coming on as your SLPs, Ashley Reed is your pay it forward best friend, we've got your mom coming on, and then we've got the episodes wrapping everything up. So Vanessa, this is a great series. Thank you very, very much for coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you. I look forward to more.
I hope today's conversation has created some aha moments for you and motivated you to become a better SLP, continuing to connect some of those missing links between what you know and how to use that knowledge. Thank you for downloading the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. And if you enjoyed the show, I'd love you to subscribe, rate it, and leave a short review. Also, please share an episode with a friend. Together, we can raise awareness and help more SLPs find and connect those missing links and get the information needed to help them feel confident in their patient care every step of the way. Follow me on Instagram and join the Fresh SLP community on Facebook. Show notes are always available, so come learn more at freshslp.com. Let's make those connections. You got this.